We are now recording, and this is Out Now with Aaron and Abe. I am Aaron, and as always, this is...
Abe! Hi, Aaron. How are you?
That's a voice.
No, this is my real voice.
I'm doing well. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you for asking. That was, I had a frog in my throat.
Oh, boy. Glad
it happens.
Out Now is a film podcast where Abe and I discuss new movies weekly. However, every now and then we have these special bonus episodes, whether it's one of our fun commentary tracks. It's still a little bit different. This is a bonus. We have a lot of bonuses we want to do because there's a lot of movies that are coming out this summer. And for this bonus episode, we're going to talk I Saw the TV Glow.
But it's buzzing in the background.
It is. It's buzzing, and I have all my lights off except the TV, so it's probably going to affect my vision, which is already poor as is. But yes, we're just going to talk. I Saw the TV Glow, the latest film from director Jane Schoenbrunn. So before we get to that, though, Abe, I have some other movies.
Trademark. Trademark.
It's a bonus. We don't normally do like.
I was like, what are we doing?
But yeah, I have a lot of, since you were gone last week, I have like I've extra stuff.
Yeah, I did a TV episode last week.
Exactly. So rather than like tilt the other episodes with all of that stuff, I think I'll split it up over these couple of bonus episodes. So, a few things I saw recently. Ezra.
Robert De Niro.
De Niro, Cannavale.
Rose Byrne.
Rainn Wilson, among others.
Really? Okay.
It's got, what's her name?
Virginia Madsen?
Vera Farmiga.
Ah, okay. Yeah. The Nuns, Vera Farmiga.
The Nuns, Vera Farmiga. No, that's Tessa Farmiga. That's the sister.
Oh, wait.
The Conjuring. The Conjuring's Vera Farmiga.
I mean, it's a family business.
The Prime series. Whoopi Goldberg.
Okay.
I'm just going to keep naming people in this cast now because it's a lot. But also William A. Fitzgerald as Ezra. It's directed by Tony Goldwyn, who's also in the movie.
Tony Goldwyn directed this movie?
Yeah, he did.
Tony Goldwyn?
TG, that's how he got Whoopi involved. They're friends.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that Tony Goldwyn directed this.
Yeah, he's got a weird career because it's this.
I mean, his family is like super wealthy. I mean, like his last name is Goldwyn for a reason.
I didn't think about that, but okay. doesn't really sell me on the idea that he was directing all these years, but okay, fine.
No, I'm just saying that, like, you know, he's got a lot of Hollywood history going on.
Okay. But no, yeah, he's directed a few things here. I don't need to go over all of them. Ezra's okay. Okay, leaning on bad. It's got kind of ally as a mentor. He plays a stand-up comedian. He has an ex-wife who's played by his real wife, Rose Byrne. He lives with his dad, played by Robert De Niro. And he has a child named Ezra, who is autistic.
Mm-hmm.
At its best is that Ezra and the depiction of autism and the way they factor that into this movie is very well done.
Okay.
And I think that's very much a key to this movie and like what they, especially now, because you can have an actual child with autism that's, you know, playing the character, which he is. And you can, there's a lot of effort being made to like not offend anybody in terms of how they're using autism. The problem with this movie is the plot. It sucks. It involves Cannavale's character. He wants the best for his son, obviously. And his ideal is that he goes to a regular school so he knows what it's like to like grow up normal. You know, like with like other kids that are all kinds of kids, as opposed to like being at a special school for kids with autism. Things happen. They're threatening to send Ezra to a special needs school. He's not having any of it. And so he kidnaps his own son and goes on a cross-country trip with him. So he can end up on a
premise sounds very familiar from like a lot of movies.
Yes, it does. His ideal goal is that he's got a spot on Jimmy Kimmel
Is this a real plot point?
This is the plot point. He has a spot on Jimmy Kimmel.
I thought
you were
just like naming Jimmy Kimmel, name dropping him. No,
it's specifically Jimmy Kimmel. He's intent on getting across the country to get Jimmy Kimmel. Meanwhile, Rose Byrne and Robert De Niro are like driving after them, trying to find him. It's the kind of thing where like there is so much well-meaning stuff going on here, and the performances are good. Like Cannavale, this is one of his best performances. He's very good in this movie, except as a stand-up. He's a terrible stand-up comedian.
Oh.
That's not even necessarily fair. He's okay in stand-up. It's that the sets that we see him do are bad. it bad in a way where it's like, this is not how this would work. And you wouldn't book a Jimmy Kimmel
set. But they're not bad on purpose, right?
No, it's just, yeah. It's
okay.
No, like having seen a lot of comedy, it's like, this isn't how this would go. And the idea that he would be booked for Jimmy Kimmel off of this is like, that's not happening. That's not a thing.
Okay.
It's unfortunate because this is very much like, if this appears somewhere on like Netflix or whatever, we'd be like, yeah, toss it on, it's fine, whatever. But as a movie overall, I'm like, it's not very good. It's got a weird plot involving a dad who kidnaps his child. Like, I'm inherently not with this, so it's very annoying to watch.
Is it relatively short?
Is it? I forget. It's an hour 40, so yeah, it's not like,
okay, so it's not bad.
It's not bad.
Like, you're not like suffering through it.
Yeah, but I wasn't. I was rooting against the actions happening from the character this film very clearly supports, which doesn't help. I watched The Dead Don't Hurt.
Remind me what this is.
This is Viggo Mortensen's Western.
Oh, the one where he's like a Swedish gentleman, right?
He's French-Canadian.
Oh, French-Canadian. Okay.
Yeah. He's French-Canadian.
But Vicky an American Creep. Immigrant, yes.
Yes, very much that factors into the plot, actually. And Vicky Creeps from Phantom Thread, she's in here as well. Also playing French-Canadian. They are two pioneers. They meet up, they form a relationship, and they get their own land and ranch.
Yeah.
Viggo Mortensen, who also wrote and directed this movie.
Right.
He goes off to the Civil War. He wants to fight for the North because he's cool. he wants to prove that he's immigrated to this country. He wants to fight for the country.
Feels American.
A noble cause. It doesn't, you know, that means he has to leave his wife for several years. Things happen.
Yes.
Eventually
trailer tells about it.
Does it? Okay, I didn't watch the trailer. I just saw Viggo Mortensen Western, cool, upsold. So I don't know what the trailer gives away. But things happen, makes things difficult. Viggo eventually comes back, and now he and his wife have to kind of like keep things. And this is like, you know, a good halfway into the movie. So like I'm trying to be vague on purpose, but essentially they have to make do with the life that they had. It's quite good. I enjoyed this movie. It's a little slow. It's a little slow. It's a Western, so I kind of expected that. But it also makes a choice to do kind of non-chronological editing. So you get kind of side-by-side glimpses of things taking place in the future versus things taking place in the past. And it's not enough for it to really justify why that choice is being made, which threw me off. Because you learn something pretty early on that happens way later in the time of this movie. And so, like, seeing the film kind of go back and forth between those, but, like, have very long stretches in between those choices, it never feels really, like, informed by, I need this to, I don't know why I needed to not see this movie take place in the order, in, like, linear order. So it's a choice that Viggo makes that I just couldn't quite get on board with. That said, when you have Viggo Mortensen and Vicky Creeps in a movie acting, like, you're not going to get a lot of bad there. Like, they're great. They do the job. Garrett Dillahunt's in here. Danny Houston's here. There's a lot of cool
Garrett characters. Dillahunt. Okay.
There's a lot of good character actors in here. A lot of Western faces. Dillahunt, obviously, he's, you know, dead little Garrett Dillahunt. And there's a guy in here who I don't think I've seen very much, but his name's Solly McLeod. He plays a character named Weston Jeffries in this movie. He is ostensibly the villain of the film. He is so good in this movie, like playing just like an absolutely despicable person. And like the kind of relatable despicable. So it's not like a cartoon.
Relatable despicable. Okay.
Yeah. Like he's not like cartoonishly evil. He's just like a guy who you know exists and you know is terrible. And he plays it so well that it's like I'm annoyed at how good he is because of how bad his character is in this movie. And it causes the right amount of conflict for things to take place. So it's a good movie. I enjoyed The Dead Don't Hurt. Quite a bit.
I'm glad. Okay.
Movie I didn't enjoy, Atlas.
Mm.
This is the Jennifer Lopez sci-fi film featuring her as a science. It's a world where AI has taken over.
Yeah. This is the movie with Simu Liu and Sterling K. Brown, right?
Sterling K. Brown as well. Yeah. Simu Liu plays like the ultimate bad AI who.
Excuse me?
The ultimate bad AI. He realized, I guess he came of he self-actualized and he became like a terrorist AI trying to get rid of humanity. and things got so bad that he like fled the planet. And so now Jennifer Lopez has been like reluctantly recruited to join Sterling K. Brown's team of mech soldiers because they found the planet he seemingly his characters on, and they're going to go, you know, take him out while using their mech army. Things happen, and it's up to just Jennifer Lopez and her mech robot to stop CBLUX here.
Okay.
Now, Jennifer Lopez, who despite being like an amazing programmer and like the master of AI and all of this, she hates technology.
Makes sense.
So like when you get your mech, you have to like pair with it. She doesn't believe in that. She wants to do it manually, which makes it difficult.
She is living in the kaiju world, right? With Guillermo del Toro, Pacific Rim. Like, she's got to pair with it, right?
She's got to pair with it, yeah.
Yeah, but she doesn't believe in it.
But she refuses to pair with it. Yeah, she doesn't want computers being in her head in the way that which is a, you know, clever commentary, of course, on America. You know what? You don't want to hear.
On America?
On the world.
Okay, yeah. I was like, yeah, I think it's more like on technology and AI, yeah.
But, you know, America.
Okay. I can see your eyes squinting when you said that.
I have a feeling Tunisia is probably not dealing with this in the same way as America is. just a thought.
What a random country poll.
But this movie's bad.
Yes, I've heard.
It's the kind of like expensive Netflix movie that looks both cheap but also like too expensive for the story it's trying to tell, which is weird. Because it's like, yes, it has like sloppy handling of battle sequences or what that all feel weightless, and as you'd expect in a giant budget Netflix movie from Brad Peyton, director of San Andreas. But it's also like the story is so thin where it's like it doesn't really need this amount of money to tell this movie.
Yeah.
So, but because they have Jennifer Lopez and Simu Liu and Sterling K. Brown, it's like, well, okay, you know, they got movie stars, so they got to like make it look like it's the real deal, but it's not. It's just bad. It's a bad movie. Not good.
Yep. Yeah. Press Roar has been hilarious because Sterling K. Brown's just been giving some side eye to Jennifer Lopez. It's been great.
Fun note, by the way, Simu Liu, who I want to say I like. I feel like he's a decent enough guy.
I think he's a decent guy. I think the jury is out on whether he's like trying too hard.
That's more the impression I get. And I'm like, I can't believe you're trying hard.
Yeah.
But that's not the right thing to be mad about. I just feel just seems very obvious that he's trying hard.
Yeah.
That said, I've been watching Kim's Convenience with my dad. It's our dinner movie or dinner show.
Hey, currently. Okay.
Well, we have dinner and we're not watching like NBA or something or baseball. We're like, oh, let's put an episode of Kim's Convenience on. Did you watch Kim's Convenience?
I've only seen a few episodes, but I'm familiar with the premise and also Simu Liu showing up in it.
So we're like one and a half seasons in. It's pretty solid. I enjoy it. It's nice seeing this is where he came from. So
exactly.
Cool.
Yeah,
like,
his Canadian roots.
So like, I like, again, I don't want to make it sound like I have a thing against Simu Liu. I don't, but at the same time, it's like, I like seeing where he's come from more in this. So yeah, Atlas sucks is the takeaway from all of this.
Okay, got it.
Last one.
Yes.
Haikyuu, the dumpster battle. Are you aware of the anime/manga series Haikyuu?
I am not, no.
It's the one about volleyball.
No. I only know the basketball one. So that's a different one. That's one that you saw the movie.
That's the last one. Yeah, the last last year.
It's called the
first Grand Slam or the...
I think so, yeah. Something like that. But yeah.
It's going to bug me. I need to know this. The first slam dunk.
Slam dunk. Yeah.
Slam.
I was like, Grand Slam is baseball.
Yeah. That's baseball. It's like, that's a big, but well, tennis has that too, but that's not tennis. It's basketball. So when I watched that last year, I had no awareness of, beyond like just recognizing, okay, there's an anime that this is based around. I had no awareness of like what this was. So I just walked into that cold and I thought it was great. I really liked that movie. So this one, the dumpster battle, best subtitle of the year so far. I similarly thought, okay, I did that one last year. Let me do this one and see if I can just go along with it. I wasn't as impressed, which is unfortunate. This one really does feel like you need to watch the show or at least have some familiarity with it to go into this version of it. It's about like the underdog volleyball teams. And I guess in the show, you're following Haikyuu and like the other teammates, and they're on like an underdog. They're like an underdog volleyball team, and then there's another team that's on that show that are also the underdogs. They never actually played each other. So this movie is them actually playing each other, hence why it's called the dumpster battle. There's plenty of stuff I like in it. It had like the volleyball stuff is neat. It's similarly done like the basketball one, where it's a one long game and you see flashbacks of things during the game. So like, it's a cool way to break up the film. I couldn't like attach myself to the story as clearly as I would have liked. And I feel like that's largely because I'm missing so much context from, I guess, four seasons of this thing, which is on Netflix. Apparently I'm not necessarily racing to Netflix to watch it, but at the same time, it's like, well, it's there. I never feel like it. Animation's fine. Like, it feels sometimes like when they're doing the volleyball action, it looks really cool. Other times it feels like there's a lot of wide shots with nothing happening. And it's like, well, that's because it doesn't have the budget to like have more. it's not a, you know, a big budget animated movie. So it's not a lot of stuff happening in the background. So it's like, it's a mixed bag. I wish I would have liked it more, but wasn't super on board with it, but I'm sure fans of the series will probably love it. So,
okay.
Yeah. So yeah, those are some out of weeks.
Trademark.
Okay. Let's do it. Let's get to the main review here for I Saw the TV Glow.
I know this might sound crazy. I don't want to alarm you.
Do you remember a TV show we used to watch together? It was called...
The Big of Eight?
Yeah. Do you watch?
Each episode, they help each other fight a new monster from across the county.
But it's way too scary for most kids.
We're gonna defeat him this time. We're gonna need to harness the full potential of our shared powers.
Sometimes the Pink Opaque feels more real than real life.
Maddie, it was a TV show.
Are you sure that's all it was?
That should have been some of the trailer for I Saw the TV Glow. I'm going to read the description that I found from Googling I Saw the TV Glow right now, just to give you a brief synopsis here. A classmate introduces Owen to a mysterious late-night TV show, a vision of a supernatural world beneath their own. In the pale glow of the television, Owen's view of reality begins to crack.
Wow.
Does that sum it up accurately?
Never reveal your sources. Does that sum it up for you?
Does that sum it up? Does that make that movie all the easier to describe now? So this is from director James Schoenberg, who previously made the film We're All Going to the World's Fair. This is her follow-up film. It features Justice Smith and Bridget Lundy Payne. That brief plot synopsis already got out the big details that we need to go through. But this was a hit at Sundance. A24 has released it into theaters all over at this point. It's made about $4 million for a movie like this. That's not bad. And I'd be very curious what the demographics are for that audience and how are they responding to it. But for the time being, Abe, I want to know from you, how did you feel about the I Saw the TV Glow?
You know, I think that this is actually a really interesting movie. It's not a perfect movie by any means, but I remember watching this movie and I was like, you know, the language is kind of, or the writing is kind of dry. It's a little bit slow pace, but when it gets to, I guess, the second act and third act for sure, I was like, this has a lot of ideas in it. And these ideas are somewhat universal and they're somewhat very micro as well. It's very fascinating topic to have for a movie where it's like, you know, Jane Schoenbrunn, very fascinating take on things like 90s TV shows and the way that 90s culture might have been as pervasive as it was. And then you kind of grow up and you kind of realize that maybe things weren't always as they seemed. And I found that to be really interesting. And there's always there's also like this sense of community and this sense of like, I guess, what's the term I'm looking for here, where there is just, there was a lot that you could talk about and you could really get lost in it. And I don't know if you knew some of these people necessarily, like, I don't know any of these people either, where they just like really believed in shit like the X-Files or really believed in shit like
took it to heart.
Yeah. Like really took it to heart. We're like, Abe, you have no, this show is trying to tell us that the government's been trying to hide stuff for years. Like, I don't know. I mean, it seems pretty crazy that that some guy's arm could be on fire and then Mulder just like asked for a light or whatever. But I really dug that this movie has a lot of really interesting ideas about who you are, who you were, kind of like the play that pop culture has in our lives, especially as we're getting older, but also in today's quote unquote, like modern society where everybody has access to a streaming service every now and again, and everyone's able to watch whatever they are watching, and kind of just be like being caught in that. I've really found it to be really fascinating on that front for things like identity and who you like, who you can become and who you latch on to be. So again, some of the dialogue kind of slow for me, but when it gets going, it actually does get going. And quite honestly, I think it's actually really well shot. There's a lot of good technical things, really cool score, really cool visuals. But yeah, I'm very like, I want people to go see it, even though I think that there was maybe some flaws for me.
Yeah, no, I found this movie really fascinating as well. I've seen it twice now at this point.
Wow. Because okay.
I couldn't get it out of my head the first time I saw it.
Yeah.
Like it, and even now I still like think about it because I do think it's a very interesting film and really interestingly put together. The things you're referencing, I agree with you. Like, you know, we can delve into what Schoenbrunn's going for as far as being a trans filmmaker who made a film mm-hmm. that's an allegory about being transgender. But like, even beyond that, for you and I who, you know, can't relate to that necessarily, the idea of identity and, you know, figuring out who you are and where we were and what you're attaching yourself to, things like that. There is a lot of relatability to this,
right?
Especially for us who are around the same age as her and came up in a time when these shows like The Pink Opaque existed. I'm with you as far as, yes, I didn't go down a rabbit hole to the point of having a mental break as far as accepting certain fiction as reality. But the way that delves into the deeper themes of the film and the way that affects both of the characters and how one who has embraced it has a different perception on things versus another who doesn't. I find that to be really interesting and acted really well. I've been a fan of Justice Smith. I think I've made that clear on this podcast several times. Despite, you know, certain films where I don't think the film shines or whatever, I do think he's a good actor. And I think he is fantastic in this movie. And he has to do a lot of heavy lifting for certain things and evolve over the course of the movie in ways that I found to be pretty stellar, especially in the same year where he starred in one of the worst movies that I've seen this year. It's like that. It's quite nice that he's in a very good movie like this.
Yeah.
And then Bridget Lindy Payne, who I only know from what, Bill and Ted's Face the Music is one of the.
I actually had to look her up. But yeah. I was like, oh, yeah, she's the daughter.
Prefer it's a they are
that's correct. Yeah, sorry. Yeah, they are the daughter in that movie.
They play a daughter in Bill and Ted.
The child of Bill or Ted.
That's Ted's daughter at the beginning. Yeah, because they have black hair and like Ted has black hair.
Yeah.
that's my logic for that one. But no, I think they are both good in this film.
Yeah.
And like you mentioned already, I mean, it's a really good looking movie. It's shot really well. It has a great, I was going to say glow, but it honestly does. It had the way it incorporates the title in this movie, I think, is rather effective. Mm-hmm. As you're literally seeing TVs glow or just a sense of glow around, like the show that they watch is called The Pink Opaque. And there's a certain atmosphere that it's going for that the movie wants to reflect as a whole. And the way that kind of gets tilted on its head later on, I think, is fascinating. The score is great. There's a lot of good camera work here. Mm-hmm. There's an extended like take of just Justice Smith walking through a school hallway at one point where I just it's not even like impressive as it's from a technical feat. It's like, yeah, OK, that's not a hard thing to do. It's just the way it's constructed. I just felt like I was really into the vibe of this movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I was a big fan. I quite enjoyed what I got out of this and continue to think about it, which I think is a good sign for a film like this that wants to be this kind of psychological study of things.
Right. I want to also caveat that we are probably going to go full spoilers. For this movie.
Good thing to mention there. Yeah, for sure.
So, and with the full spoiler thing, Aaron and I both enjoyed this, I think. But here I go into some spoilers. I thought that this movie was actually going to go into, as it kept unraveling itself to the viewer, I was thinking to myself, oh, I am now, I wonder if I'm actually living this almost like a Charlie Kaufman-esque type movie where I've been watching them, but they've actually just been the actors in this show. And to some degree, they kind of played that out too in like the second and third act. But I was actually thinking to myself, oh no, like I'm actually just watching the Pink Opaque type thing, right? And they're not necessarily living it, but I've kind of just meted myself, you know, like fourth wall braked myself kind of thing, because there's a lot of details in this movie, which I think is incredible. You know, I think that Jane Schoenbrunn has really paid attention to a lot of details, whether that be like the actual Doritos in the 90s, the bags that they had.
A lot of little details like that I appreciated. For sure.
Right. Yeah. But as they're going through the hallways there, like there's a lot of like time manipulation here, too, where we're starting at like 1994, I believe, or 1996. And you're going through the hallways. And then 2 years pass and he's going through the hallways again and it's still 1996. And I was like, I just knowing that they've paid attention to all these details, this is not a mistake. Right. So I was like, I'm wondering what I'm watching here, but I dig it. You know, I dug that it was very at times kind of like putting together like this very dark puzzle, but also just a really fascinating take on, again, pop culture in America and pop culture as we grew up and Jane grew up. Like you mentioned that we're all very similar age, and I would think that we are actually. I think we're all like in mid late 30s kind of thing. So very fascinating just to see all this unfold. But I'm curious like your take on that aspect before we, I guess, dive into like the third act stuff. But I'm just curious like your eye for detail in this movie.
Detail wise, I certainly noticed plenty of stuff. Even like the show itself, like the font for the credits is from Buffy. There's a lot of references to like not only Buffy, but things like Are You Afraid of the Dark, other right. WB shows from that time, other Nickelodeon late night shows from that. Like, so it all felt very familiar in a fitting way. Not even just clever, because it's like, yeah, it's, you know, they did the thing, but it's like fitting and, you know, warm as far as I know what this is, despite it being a fake version of a thing that I know.
Which
is fun. As far as thinking it had this extra meta layer to it, my mind didn't go there. I like that yours did. That's an interesting way that it could have gone, for sure. It's interesting that the film is, it's probably simpler than you might like in terms of like plotting. It's simpler than one may expect it to be. Like, there's plenty of stuff going on from like a cerebral level, but in terms of like what it's laying out in front of you, it doesn't really have those kinds of twists and turns. It's really just like two people watched the show, one went away, then came back. Like there's not a lot.
Yeah, that's pretty much what it is. Yeah.
That's basically what it amounts to.
Yeah.
So I appreciate that it's able to kind of really just push me in because of what Justice Smith is delivering as the narrator of this thing, and really get us into his mindset throughout the movie. Because I agree with you that like it has a certain, I would say like bad pacing. It's just, it has like a certain flow to it that you certainly have to adjust to far as what kind of tone it wants to be. And because even like trying to define what this movie is, like, it's not quite a drama. It's not a horror. It's not a sci-fi. It's not a fantasy. It's like, it's a lot of things in one, which is always cool. And that's fairly A24 of them to not have a strict genre they're aiming for. But yeah, in terms of like, accepting what this movie is like presenting to me, didn't quite go down like a deeper thought with that rabbit hole. It's just more of taking in the world that it was being presented, and I appreciated what it ultimately had to deliver.
So I do want to get into like some spoiler stuff here, and essentially I wasn't sure what happened when Bridget Lindy Payne's character kind of disappears, because I was thinking to myself, well, she probably just ran away, but there was like the police, do not look cross lines. So like, I don't know if she was murdered, but she just goes away for a while. And then it's revealed that she kind of just really believes that she is one of the protagonists in this movie, or in this TV show that they've been watching for when they were preteens, teenagers. And she just, I'm actually curious how you thought about this. Like, I don't know if she's lost her mind, but I was also just like, maybe they are in this TV show. This is very curious to me.
I would argue it becomes more pure theme by the end of it, as opposed to plot based. So like the actual existence of Maddie at that point is, I can argue, is ambiguous. Like, either
interesting,
they are out there or not, I would say. But regardless, the key to it is that Maddie has Maddie has, for me, Maddie has accepted a certain level of reality that they feel comfortable with, mm-hmm. and they're willing to explore, and they want to keep exploring. Whether or not this is all in her head, or she's not even there, whatever, she is in a state of play, like her, the Maddie character is in a state of mind where they are doing what exactly what they feel they're supposed to be doing, and it's presented as such. For Owen, for Justice Smith's character,
mm-hmm.
he has found himself in a place where he doesn't know what he is. He didn't accept Maddie's invitation to come along with him.
Right.
And so now he's stuck in a world where, I mean, on the outside, it seems fine. He, as he grows up, he apparently has a family. He had a...
That's what he tells the audience.
He tells the
audience.
Never
see it.
But yeah. He had a rough childhood as far as his mom died early, and then his father, played by Fred Durst,
which we'll talk about,
was never wasn't abusive, but wasn't, you know, the strongest.
Wasn't very present father.
Wasn't very present. Yeah, and so by the end of this thing, he's in a state where I don't think he knows whether or not he has a family. He doesn't know what he wants. He doesn't. He lost the opportunity to kind of delve more into what could have been, and that just presents him in this horrible position of like not knowing what's going to come out of this. If this is all speaking to theme, thematically speaking, if we're talking about this being an allegory for being transgender,
mm-hmm.
Maddie has accepted who they are, right? Maddie has gone on, and like, regardless of like what that means as far as her reality goes, and like whether or not they are crazy for thinking about this show, or whether they're actually in the show, whatever,
right?
They are in a position where they've gone on to take on like, this is the thing, this is what I am. Owen is not. Owen has found himself in a place where he hasn't transitioned. He hasn't done anything beyond just have this weird feeling with himself that he's not who he's supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I think the ending is pretty crazy, where he gets to this point where he's like literally screaming and like ripping his chest open and all this stuff. Cause it's like all these feelings he has about everything are just like, he can't do it. He doesn't know what to do with them. It's a really bad spot for him. So that's where I'm at with like all of this.
Yeah, I, that's a really good reading of it. I want to travel back for a second here, because when we're talking about themes of identity and how Owen, it's very fascinating because, again, the 90s were, it was progressive, and yet also like when you look back at it, it's also like pretty conservative, especially compared to today. So when they're having that discussion around like, hey, can I go watch the Pinko Pake over at like Maddie's house or whatever? And Fred Durst is like, takes a beat and is like, isn't that a girl show? I was like, that is basically like the binary that we kind of talked about like in the 90s. Like, oh, isn't this like Buffy? If you were to watch Buffy, it's like, isn't that a girl show? Or like the X-Files, or even some other show that it might have been for anybody. But then it kind of wasn't deemed as like manly, or it wasn't deemed, or it kind of felt in like only two camps. I found that to be very fascinating. And then like what you're saying here, he kind of just like keeps going. Like Owen just keeps going with whatever he's deciding to do with his life. You know, he kind of just like lives this quote unquote like regular life, in which he says in the movie, he's like, I just decided to that I had to grow up. I had to become like a man or whatever. And so he has a family of his own. He changes out, you know, a tube TV for a flat screen TV. But all these things still persist of I don't know if I truly am who I am. And I found that to be really fascinating toward the third act, of just him living his life, always apologizing for every like little thing that he thinks that he's doing wrong. To which nobody even cares or listens, and kind of just like having a weird mental lapse of just, I don't know what this is, but is this actually all that there is to life? Which, you know, a lot of movies try and tackle, but I thought that this is a really fascinating look at, like, if you were to kind of pink opaque it, and just think that they actually are in the show and everything that Maddie had told Owen is true. That's a very interesting read too. I'm just like, oh, okay, well, you know, now I'm watching like the continuation of the show as it plays out. But if you don't read it that way and you just decide to, if you kind of take it more literal minus like him opening his chest up and not dying. But if you take it more literal of this is the life that he chose, and also it's just a boring life when you decide that you don't actually want to live your life and you kind of just want to watch your life, that's a really like sad read. And again, a lot of movies will tackle this theme as well. So yeah, it's cool that we both have kind of like different-ish reads on this while we're still like kind of like in the same parking lot.
I think we're circling the same stuff. Yeah,
exactly. So it's really cool that this movie can bring about this kind of discussion.
And he works at a Chuck E. Cheese or whatever, you know.
Yeah,
something like that, which is, it's like he's a family man who works at a Chuck E. Cheese.
Like, I mean, he's been working there for like 15 years. And also...
And not even a manager?
Yeah, do you know who his boss is?
Who plays his boss?
Connor O'Malley in the most Connor O'Malley role ever. So like Connor O'Malley is like a writer for, he used to write with Seth Meyers, and he used to write in SNL. And he's married to A.D. Bryant, who's an SNL guest member. And, you know,
okay,
he just does like a lot of like weird shit like on YouTube. So it's part of like his comedy style is just like he's really off kilter. He's the brother in Detroiters. He's Tim Robinson's brother in Detroiters.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I was like, this is such a Connor O'Malley role. But still, yes, yeah, it's kind of like a weird thing. Because again, if you decide to kind of just view your life versus living your life, then yes, you will kind of just accept the things that come to you, right? And in some cases, Owen has kind of accepted that. You know, he works at like a video store, and then the video store shuts down. So Connor O'Malley gets a different job, and Connor O'Malley brings him along. And here he is just like aging, becoming this old man and deciding that this is just really it for him. And I really find it fascinating when he's thinking about like, well, maybe Maddie was right. Like maybe I should have gone into the spaceship or whatever and decided to like bury myself
and he's,
wake up.
He's missed his opportunity too, because he watches The Pink Opaque on a streaming service years later.
Which is a hilarious, like, yeah, yeah.
It's not the same show that he remembered. Now, I find that
I have a different take on this, yeah.
I find that interesting because it's, on the one hand, it's the kind of thing where like when you're a kid, you like exaggerate things in your head or what have you.
Yeah, yeah.
And so like when we see clips of The Pink Opaque, when it gets to like the monsters of the week, they look grotesque and horrific. There's this like ice cream man character that looks like just gnarly.
Yeah.
And then when you get to the streaming show version of it, when he's an adult watching it again, it's just like a friendly ice cream man. It's like, he doesn't look like particularly scary in any way whatsoever. It's just like,
right.
Oh, okay. You know, the show's effects weren't as good as I thought they were.
Yeah, and I found that to be really fascinating because mm-hmm. I have been in that situation where I don't know if you have, but where you've watched things as kids and then you watch them again as an adult, you're like, yeah, it's actually not as effective. You know, something like this that I think about not all the time, but whenever it does come up, whether it's Halloween or something else, is Scream, right? And I remember watching Scream in 1996, 97 on VHS, and we were watching it, and I was just like scared out of my brain, right? Because I was like, oh, this guy is, it's like he's gonna go kill all these people. And then as you get older, and I remember us talking about it a while back, you know, the entire series, and we talk about it almost seemingly every year because there's a new one being released. But I was like, yeah, these are just a bunch of teenagers, and some of them are not very good or adept at like killing people. They're just like goofy. And it's actually surprisingly very funny too. Like the movie is very funny, in a way that is like somewhat slapstick and physical humor, but also just from the way that they write their lines is humorous. And I find this always like that scene when he watches The Pink Opaque and he's like, it's very different from what I remember. And it's like, this is it's not a unique feeling, because I think a lot of people will look back at something that might've been scary, or like, even I think more universally, I used to think that my house is very big when I was a kid. And then you grow up and you're like, it's actually not very big.
Yeah, I think that's more the thing. Like, I get what you're saying with Scream, but like Scream is still the same movie. Like, you're just older and you're perceiving it differently. Like,
sure. Yeah, yeah.
You're looking at it in a new light because you're like, you're less focused.
You have a lot of experience under your belt at the point.
But like, you're not, Ghostface doesn't look like a horrible monster when you're a child.
No, Ghostface.
Like, I think
I mean, like, I think like thematically in the kills, you're just like, oh, yeah, this is actually kind of goofy.
Well, yeah, because your head's not focused on the scares as much anymore. We're like, this thing, it's like, this kid thought that there was a fucking ice cream man that was going to melt his brain at some point, and now he's looking at this like, this looks like a guy wearing a big hat. It's like, that's sure. It's a big difference in his head, and it is neat as far as presenting something that seems very yes, I do agree. Seems very universal as far as perception at a certain age and how things change based on who you are or what you're accepting. And I think that does stem into where Owen is as a person at that point, where if there was ever a door open to him moving on with Maddie and doing, like, that's closed now. And I think that's partially reflected in him seeing the pink opaque and no longer seeing the magic in it anymore. It's just not, like, within his head to, like, observe it in that way. He sees the show for what the world wants the show to see, what the world wants him to see the show as, just this regular kid show that doesn't really actually mean anything.
Regular kid show. Yeah. I think that's also, like, fine, right? Like,
it is fine, ultimately, yeah, for the majority of the population, I would say. Like, Owen is a character who he doesn't know what he wants anymore. Like, he's stuck in this weird limbo.
His mundane life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, yeah.
The Fred Durst thing, by the way. You mentioned Fred Durst.
Want to talk about Fred Durst, yeah.
You mentioned, like, yeah, like, one of his, he doesn't have many lines in this movie.
No.
Like, well, the one thing that sticks out is, yeah, it's like, isn't that a show for girls? The fact that that's embodied by 1999's new metal god, peak masculinity, all of that, that he's playing, like, a figurehead in that realm, speaking to his son about this very thing. That's a very clear choice. And, yeah, like, it's so clear that, like, I wonder if that was even explained to Fred Durst, or he just, like, oh, that's a cool
idea. I'm sure that he got it. Yeah.
I mean,
he makes movies.
He does. He's a filmmaker in his own right. And he's stuck. Like, regardless of what you think of Fred Durst's films,
right? Yeah.
He made the Travolta movie. He shadowed Fincher for a film just because he wanted to get
I didn't know that.
He wanted to understand how the directing process worked. Like, he's, again, regardless of quality, he's putting in the effort, which I always admire. I can always appreciate.
Of course, yeah. But I identified the same thing that you did, which is, like, this is Fred Durst. Mm-hmm. Which, when I was watching the credits, I was like, who's their dad? And I was like, Fred Durst is in this movie?
Yeah.
There could only be one person that Fred Durst played.
And it's not the, like, ice cream man.
Exactly. But exactly what you said. He's a 90s figurehead of, like, you know, testosterone, ego, and he's mellowed out through the years. But still, it was just like, this is a perfect example of just, like, this guy who did represent all the things that were, like, kind of, like, not the opposite of what this movie is trying to portray, but just, like, that a 90s embodiment of, like, male masculinity. And it's very fascinating for him to, like, choose that. And they're both probably in the know, like, both the director Jane and also Fred Durst are probably in the know of just, like, what he's doing there. Mm-hmm. But, you know, he doesn't do a whole lot, but there was, like, one point where I found him super creepy, where Justice Smith is just apologizing for being late, and he's looking at him on the couch. Mm-hmm. He's just not saying anything. I was like, is he dead?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was like, he's not dead, but still, it's very creepy because at that point, you're not really sure what's actually happening in the movie. There could be, like, a lot of things that are going on. But yeah, Fred Durst showing up, and I want to get to something else, because, like, Fred Durst, like you mentioned, white guy, his mom is black. Mm-hmm. So
Danielle Deadwyler, who's also
Deadwyler, who is I think we've seen her in, like, a lot of things.
Yeah, she's in the Harder They Fall, the Western.
Yes, and she's also, like, the mother in Till.
Yes,
but cool. But that makes Owen biracial, right? Mm-hmm. And that is also, while they don't, like, focus on that a whole ton, like, there is still this component of...
Who am I?
Who am I? Yeah. Like, and you know, not to say that the 90s were, like, a long time ago. They kind of are. They're, like, 20, 30 years ago at this point. But being biracial just wasn't something that a whole lot of people were like, oh, well, you know, like, it's pretty normal. It's like, it kind of wasn't. Like, you're biracial, but it's like, you know, you probably can speak more to this than I can, because I've only known a few other folks growing up where I was that were biracial, but it wasn't a normal occurrence. And so, like, just kind of being in both worlds is very fascinating read for this movie as well, in terms of both, you know, your sexuality, but also who you are as a person. Like, there's a lot that's going on here.
Yeah, I would agree. And I do think the film isn't really commenting on it in a way that it, at least consciously, or at least from my perspective as a person, yes, there's also a mixed race. I just didn't, like, see Justice Smith specifically, or Jane Schoenberg's screenplay or what have you, specifically, like, tapping into that at all. But I absolutely agree with you. It is an aspect that can make a difference depending on where you are in environment. Now, this is a film that already has a number of things on its mind. I don't feel like it's specifically trying to tap into that. And I think part of that comes with the fact that he's in the suburbs, an area where, depending on which suburbs, but similar to where I'm at, it's not consciously the kind of issue that I see being dealt with in that kind of an area where it's not as if he has to like code switch between friend groups or the company he's keeping or what have you. It's a suburbs where everyone is pretty much the same, or at least trying to embody a similar type of thing. That's the nature of the suburbs. That's why it's boring. which is what Maddie's getting at. It's like, they want to get out of there.
Want to get out of there. Yeah. I mean, like even Maddie herself, she proclaims in the movie that she's a lesbian, right? So there's just a lot of really, again, these characters are just more than what they are on the surface.
Now, we can speak to the fact that they're both isolated individuals. Maddie, for obvious reasons, because she embraces the fact that she is an open lesbian, and she's obsessed with this TV show. Like she's pretty much, I mean, she sits alone on bleachers to have lunch or whatnot.
Don't know much about her home life, but it seems as though there's like not a perfect home life.
She implies that she gets beaten by her. She's been beaten by her father,
stepfather or something.
Meanwhile, Owen also seemingly isolated. I mean, he's also like, we don't get a ton of like them in school, but like, he's also, he's not hanging out with other friends or anything. He similarly kind of like sheepishly going up to Maddie to have lunch. Like, it's not a lot there. So even when he's like a younger kid, he's kind of doing his own thing. He's not at the school dance or whatever they're at, or like it's an election.
It's an election night. Yeah. She takes him to go show him how to vote,
which is I guess that's a thing. I've never seen that, but because it looked, the setup looks like, oh yeah, okay, it's like a school dance or something. They're voting.
Exactly. Yeah. He puts his hand on the board and you see like Al Gore, or I mean, sorry, Bill Clinton, George Bush and all that other stuff. Yeah.
So I was like, okay, that's interesting.
Right. I want to ask you about the Pinko Pig and whether it was something that. So this is a series that is on TV. Everybody knows about it. It's being written about in magazines. And, young Owen is kind of watching like Nick at Night kind of thing as it switches over into like the late night programming. And it's a show that he doesn't watch live, so he gets videotapes of them, and he gets videotapes of them from Maddie. But I wanted to ask you, like, is at a certain point, is it kind of that she's been manipulating some of the tapes? Not that she's making her own show, but that they're kind of all, like, out of order-ish, so she's kind of helping to program, like, the way that he views the show, too? Like, I don't know what your take was on that, because she shows him, she's like, oh, I finally left you the last episode. I was like, he hasn't seen the last episode of the show?
I don't think that she's necessarily like changing the show in any way, doing anything to manipulate the show itself.
The
take I have is that the show it's either been over or it's often between seasons, and so she's just recording the reruns and giving them to him as they can. Why the show why its syndication is not airing the show in order, that's odd to me, but I don't know. I can't speak to it. It's also weird that it's like a 10:30 show, so it's a half an hour show, I guess.
Well, they said it's like an hour long. Yeah,
it's an hour, but it starts at 10:30. It's weird. should start at the top of the hour, Dan.
No, they're pulling a late night,
and it's for kids, but it's at 10:30. It's like that should be like Are You Afraid of the Dark was at 9 o'clock. Like that was at SNICK Saturday Night Nickelodeon. Where the
when was like Buffy on like 8:30? It was Buffy like a primetime show.
Buffy was an 8 o'clock show WB and UPN. Like
UPN.
That was just a normal television show.
Right.
So it's like I can't get a grip around how this was functioning exactly.
Sure.
So I think it's less about Maddie doing anything to like
I'm not saying that she's like cutting her own show.
I don't think she's doing anything out of the ordinary beyond like adding a post-it or some additional notes on top of whatever tapes that she's presenting to him.
And, to speak to the whole entire show and how it just ends, like shows end abruptly all the time, whether they don't get renewed or picked up for like a whatever season. So it's totally understandable that the show ends on a cliffhanger and nobody knows what happens. And so that's why she takes it upon herself that she knows the answer, and that the only answer must be that they are the people in the show. And so I actually love the flashbacks that they have, where it's just like Justice Smith is the person in the dress. I forget the character's name. There's like two protagonists of the show.
There's Isabel and Tara.
Yeah. So he's playing like the Isabel character and Tara's like, you know, on a different place. Mm-hmm. And I actually really loved it. I was like, this is really clever the way that you're doing this. Again, more for all the allegory that we're talking about, like with trans and also identity and everything else too. But just making an audience member really just, I'm just thinking to myself, are they? Like, what have I been watching this whole time? And I found that to be really fun visually just to see, even though it kind of fizzles out to some degree. But I really dug that there was a part of me that was just really stuck on. I think that this is a really clever directorial trick that they might play, which they don't really live out. But still, it was a really clever way to reintroduce a character, Maddie, and also just reintroduce the concept of why don't you think that there was ever like a closeout episode? You know, it was a popular show. Why don't you think that it ever finished out? Probably because we have to finish it up, because you and I are both the protagonists in this. And it's like, this is pretty cool what's happening here.
I agree with you. Like, it's why I wanted to see it again. It's why I look forward to watching it more. Like, it has all this stuff going on as far as what it wants to do with these characters and like having them assert themselves in certain ways, and one seeming far more confident in like what they're getting out of it than the other. I just legit find that all fascinating.
Yeah. I do want to watch it again.
Very good use of special effects, by the way. You know, for a movie like there's a number of things involving TVs. There's a head being shoved into a TV screen. Then, like the use of that and sound design in one, I think, is really interesting. Mm-hmm. Obviously there's a lot of practical stuff, like that damn ice cream thing I keep mentioning, and then the ending thing with the whole chest coming open and you know the TV inside of it, but like it's a continuous shot, so you like still see Justice Smith.
Yeah.
And it's like, I'm smart enough with film things to like, I get how that was done, but at the same time it's like, it's still impressive. It's enough where I'm like, this is a really solid use of visual effects in a movie that does not have a high budget. It's a very visually striking film, which like with like some clever things going on in there as far as how to like visualize what they're going for.
Okay. Yeah, definitely agreed. I mean, again, I don't know what the budget was. Do you know offhand?
I can't imagine it's higher than $5 million.
Yeah. I mean, again, really, really positive use of their budget for what they were doing here. And I often think to myself that movies that kind of, I don't think that Jane was necessarily challenging herself around this stuff. But at the same time, I often dig that if you have a limited budget and you're able to do a ton with it, the most recent example being Godzilla Minus One, and people were just like really impressed by that budget. Mm-hmm. It's like, yeah, I mean, you could do a lot of things if you decide that it's not going to have like a ton of special effects, or you're not going to like shoot live in Australia or whatever. You know what I mean? Like, this all looks like it takes place in like a few different spots in like one different city or in one city, but still it's pretty contained. And I think like the most effects that they might've done were probably like redoing this 90s TV show. And then perhaps like a lot of like the cool neon shit in the streets. Right? Yeah. So, yeah, like again, I did not see We're All Going to the World's Fair. But that one, I don't know if it was that definitely was not a lot of money.
No,
but it's pretty clever the way that she conceives of movies and the way that she kind of executes on them.
If you like the general aesthetic of this, then you'll get something out of that movie. I wasn't huge on it in the same way that I know a lot of people were when it came out. But I appreciate it. But
sure.
this certainly feels like the kind of step up a director has when they have a bit more money and, you know, more freedom to do what they, I mean, it's not like that movie was being constricted by studios or anything. It's an indie movie, but just more like of a more know-how of what they want to go after.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Anything else on I saw the TV Glow?
No, I do want to watch it again. And I also, again, would encourage people to go and check it out. It does move kind of slow at times. So the pacing is, it's not that it's deliberate, but it has It has its own pace, and the dialogue is not always that engaging. But I kind of don't knock it because of the ideas that it has and kind of what it's going for aesthetically, but also thematically. So, like, I know that I watched it with, like, a fairly somewhat packed audience, and this is a really small theater. There's probably only, like, you know, like 50 seats or whatever. But still, I think that people were maybe a little bit disappointed by it. And it's like, I can see that. I think those feelings are validated. But I think that there's still a lot under the surface that this movie's trying to do.
Yeah, I certainly feel like there's a mood you need to be in if you're wanting to see a movie like this and accept what it's going for. At the same time, if you're seeking out a movie called I Saw the TV Glow, unless you're just going into the theater blind, I'd like to think that you have some idea of what you're trying to get into, and ideally you enjoy what you get out of it, because it certainly has a lot to offer.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Great.
Great.
That's going to do it for this bonus episode about Now With Their Name. You can find our show everywhere. You can find podcasts. We're all over the place. Follow us on all the socials and all that.
Yeah, we're on the internet.
Yep. Stay tuned. We have more bonus episodes coming your way, as well as our main reviews for various movies. We have Bad Boys Ride or Die as their next main review at the time of this recording. And plenty more coming through this summer of 2024. So,
oof.
Yeah, that's going to do it for this week. For this bonus episode.
So this bonus episode.
Yeah. Till next time, so long.
And leave your TVs off.